WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com. Yes.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For 45 years, North Carolina engaged in the practice of eugenics, the forced sterilization of countless citizens as the result of dubious scientific beliefs and on the flimsiest of evidence. That practice, as misguided and seemingly medieval as it was, didn't end until 1974. Now, like so many other wrongs in our past, we are debating what to do for the victims. State officials have apologized, but is that enough? And what is the right thing to do? Would monetary reparations be right? Would they be fair, especially to those who would have to foot the bill, today's generation, who had no say in the policies, practices, or mistakes of the previous generations? It is a question that seems to repeat itself through history, so today we're going to take a closer look at the ethics of reparation. Do we have an obligation to right the wrongs of the past? Joining us to talk about that are three members of the Department of Communications at UNC Charlotte. Dr. Dan Grano is an associate professor there whose research focuses on how power shapes moral judgment, especially surrounding issues of race. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Dr. Maggie Quinlan is assistant professor in the department whose work explores and critiques existing power structures and works towards the empowerment of groups marginalized in society. Good to see you as well.
Thanks, Mike.
Elliot Hamer is a master's degree student there, studying, teaching, and assisting professors with their research in the Department of Communications. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
And also with us, Kirsten Sickley, CEO of the YWCA of Charlotte. They have made exploring the topic of eugenics one of their missions, it seems, and are sponsoring a program on the topic, asking, Did Race and Money Matter? On Tuesday, January 29th at 8 a.m., who can start earlier than this program? We have information about that, of course, on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Welcome.
Thank you, Mike.
Let me start with you, Kirsten. Why has the YWCA taken up this topic?
Well, the YWCA's mission nationally is around the elimination of racism and the empowerment of women and the promotion of peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all people. And so the topic of eugenics, where we are exploring how women have been marginalized, particularly women of color and poor women, is very much in line with our mission. Over the last 3 years, we've done a number of community breakfast forums where we've explored issues of race and discrimination. And once we met Maggie and Dan and learned about the work they've been doing with Elliot, it just seemed like a fantastic opportunity to share their findings with the greater public.
Well, I was going to ask you why you chose three people from the Department of Communications at UNC Charlotte and not the Department of Philosophy or the Department of Political Science with regard to this topic.
Well, it's all about relationships, and we actually had one already with Maggie, mm-hmm. who is a member of the YWCA's Fitness Center and is very actively engaged there, but also who has been doing research on a program we have there called Getting Ahead in a Just Getting By World, interviewing some of our transitional housing participants. Mm-hmm. So that led to the conversation about the research that she and Dan and Elliot have been doing.
Well, let me ask them, why are you doing research on this topic? What has it got to do with the Department of Communications? I'm not sure which one of you to take that, but Dr. Grano, go ahead.
Well, it is fundamentally a communication problem when you come down to negotiating, whether in the state legislature or in the public sphere, what the ethical standards are by which we meet obligations to the past and what those obligations call upon us to do in the present. They're philosophical questions, to be sure. They're political questions, but they're questions that come down to the kind of language that we use to figure those problems out.
I'm still having trouble understanding this, but I want to hear from you as well, Maggie. Maybe you can explain it better to me.
Sure.
So, well, I'll put my dunce cap on.
All of us are interested really in the language used to talk about people, especially for me as somebody who studies women's bodies, individuals with disabilities who were primarily who were the targets of eugenics and who were sterilized often against their will. So for me, the language we use to talk about people with disabilities, women's bodies, African Americans, single mothers, individuals on welfare are all issues that keep coming up in these debates about the reparations and whether or not to give financial compensation to individuals who were sterilized against their will.
The topic of eugenics has been in the news a lot in the last year or so, and we've done several programs on it. I know our news department has devoted several news series to covering the debates in Raleigh about what to do about this. So it's unlikely that many of our listeners are not familiar with the topic. But just in case there are, because when this first came up, I knew nothing about North Carolina's participation in this and the fact that other states around the country had done this. When was this prevalent? Why did it start?
Well, the methods and the science behind eugenics, the goal of it was to improve the human race, especially improving qualities that we wanted to see more in the human race, as well as qualities that were seen as deviant that we wanted to decrease. So it was either positive or negative eugenics. And people believed that certain ethnicities, certain racial groups were superior in terms of intelligence, in terms of character. And so people wanted to see those reproduced in society. And so, many people ask me the question, is eugenics racist? And I think that's a really interesting question, because the founders of eugenic science would not necessarily have considered themselves racist. Yet the way that it played out, the way that the science played out, was that the white man was put at the top of the hierarchy, and then everyone who was below that was seen as being inferior or less than that. So the way that it ended up playing out in North Carolina was people who were seen as deviant, people who were seen as criminals, people who were seen as a burden on the state were the ones who were targeted. And so in how it played out in North Carolina especially, it did have very racist, classist implications.
How many other states were involved in this practice when it was going on?
Yeah, well, 33 out of 50 states actually had programs similar to the ones that we had in North Carolina.
And back when this was going on, there were probably only 48 states.
Well,
so the percentage was even higher.
Yeah, and what we see is that North Carolina's law, the way it was written, had a lot of vagueness written into it. It said that
deliberately so.
Well, I mean, we look at the terminology that was used. Feeble-mindedness was overwhelmingly the description that was given to people that were, brought in to be sterilized. And the question of, well, what is feeble-mindedness is kind of a vague term. It was measured using IQ tests. And the IQ tests at the time were, they were pretty simple tests measuring culturally relative standards. So, tests generated in one area and applied to another, it's hard to draw inference from that. But they were being drawn, and people were being labeled as feeble-minded. Other areas had laws that only let people be sterilized if they were in-state institutions. Our law was written in a way where it was able to creep out of institutions and prisons and into the general population.
And how did that happen? I mean, did they come after certain people? Did they have to be on welfare so the system was aware of you? How did they find these? How did they target, identify, and then go after these people?
Well, statistics were something, data is something that the state had. The Eugenics Board after World War II was run by a man by the name of Wallace Corral, and he was head of welfare also.
This is Mecklenburg County, right?
In Mecklenburg County, yes. And so the prerogative kind of shifted from the original eugenics that were tied to Galton, Francis Galton, that were more socially based. It turned more to economic reasons. So looking for a reason to stop welfare, to end the welfare. To end welfare was prerogative at that time.
So in other words, ending the hope for ending welfare at that time using this method was to fix the gene pool so that people would not be prone to rely on help or have to rely on it because they were, quote, feeble-minded, end quote. You asked the question, Maggie, is it racist? A lot of African-American people were targeted. A lot of women, African-American women, were targeted in North Carolina. Was that the case in the 32 other of the 48 states that practiced this, or was it more broadly spread out across the population? there?
It was strikingly African-American women on welfare at the end of before 1974. So it was primarily that in North Carolina. And what was interesting about North Carolina was that as other states were finding out about the atrocities of the Holocaust and Nazi Germany, they started to ramp down their eugenics programs, where North Carolina really ramped theirs up.
Which I want to talk about in a second, but I also want to talk about North Carolina. Was it because you mentioned Wallace Corralt, who was famous mostly because of his son, Charles, who was he was a friend of mine, a great guy. But anyway, he saw this as a way to lessen dependence on the welfare state. So was it a racial issue for him, or was it a cost containment issue for him and others who saw it this way?
Well, looking, it's hard to peer into the motivations, but what we do know is that social workers were actively going out into the community, engaging the community, talking to families, and in some instances, using coercive tactics to get these sterilizations to happen, and the drive at that time does seem to be more on an economic basis. But it was very much informed from this eugenics standpoint that if we perform these sterilizations, these bloodlines will be cut off, and that the stock, that human stock will improve.
And Mecklenburg County was the leader in North Carolina in these sterilization procedures. We did more of them. Was that because of Wallace Corralt, or was it because of other factors?
Yeah, well, I mean, historically, Mecklenburg County did perform more, three times more than any other county, which totaled 485 men, women and children. And it's tough to tie it to to one thing. Wallace Corralt did become the commissioner of the Board of Eugenics in 1945. And at that time is when the tactics began to change, when we see less doctors, medical professionals being involved in the advocation of sterilization, and more social work, directly tied to welfare happening.
Less people believe that this is strictly a North Carolina problem, a Mecklenburg County problem within North Carolina. This was, as you said, is happening in 33 states across the country for a long period of time in the early 20th century. And in writing the majority opinion in a Supreme Court case on the issue, Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, "It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough." This is the majority opinion of the Supreme Court of the United States. Sounds incredibly harsh and uninformed by today's standards. But for some, the argument is still being made that society should not have to support those who cannot support themselves.
The interesting Oliver Wendell Holmes comment about three generations of imbeciles are enough, that is really powerful, because that put the state in control of reproduction and it's never, even to this day, been overturned. So that statement really, has had long-lasting impact of states' control over people's bodies.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and follow up on that a little bit in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Winston-Salem State University, celebrating a history of providing educational opportunities to all with a diverse student body of more than 6,000 students. Details at wssu.edu. Here's a question. Are we alone in the universe? We've been pondering that for eons. It's only been the last 60 years or so that we've been truly able to go out into space and do our a little exploration of our own. We put men on the moon. We're exploring Mars right now. But every single day, it seems, astronomers and other astrophysicists are discovering new planets in other solar systems, raising the question once again, does someone live out there? We talk to an astrophysicist about that and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Secretary Clinton's testimony on Benghazi and understanding security risks in North Africa.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with three people from the Department of Communications at UNC Charlotte, Dr. Dan Grano, Dr. Maggie Quinlan, and master student Elliot Hamer. Also with us is Kirsten Sickley, CEO at the YWCA, because they are sponsoring a similar conversation on the topic of eugenics. Theirs is called Did Race and Money Matter? We're looking at the ethics of all this. I just mentioned Oliver Wendell Holmes, a Supreme Court justice, famous Supreme Court justice, who wrote the deciding opinion or the majority opinion on a case called Buck versus Bell. It stemmed from a case regarding eugenics in Virginia. And the language that I just quoted from him is really, really harsh. And you mentioned off the air, Kirsten, that even today when we talk about this, when we talk about reparations, when the state Senate was debating this, the language is at the very least paternalistic still.
Absolutely. An unexamined assumption made that poor parents, poor mothers, poor fathers cannot be good parents. And at the YWCA, that particularly hits close to home because our work is with low-income parents and low-income individuals. In our 11 youth learning centers, 85% of the families that we're serving are earning less than $15,000 a year. But some of the finest parents I've ever met who also want their children to have, as all parents do, lives better than they have had and opportunities greater than they have had. And so, you know, although there are sometimes truths among those assumptions and there are troubled parents and there are sometimes poor parent styles, that blanket assumption that poverty means poor parenting is offensive.
And it's not genetic.
It's not genetic. No. Poverty can happen to anyone, and we've certainly seen that happen during the recession.
The theory of eugenics, as I understand it, was developed in the late 1800s by people who did not fully understand the science behind genetics. But it didn't start here till 1929. Actually, I've read two dates, 1919 and 1929. Which is the correct date?
Well, yeah, I mean, for our state particularly, there's a few different dates that we could consider them, you know, what started it. The law that was repealed in 2003 in our state was drawn up in 1933. There was a law before that that was written in 1929 that was found unconstitutional because there was no oversight, no regulation. And so when the law was drawn up in 1933, which stayed on the books for many years, created the Eugenics Board to create oversight, a way that for people to, you know, repeal the process as well.
Was that the only difference, that the new law had regulatory considerations?
I think it's the most noteworthy.
So if this theory came about in the 1800s, why did it take us at least 19 years, perhaps 29 years to put it into practice here? Did it gain traction slowly around the country? Was anybody talking about the ethics of this? Were there any arguments at the time about whether this should be done, whether it was the right or wrong thing to do?
Well, I can first just say that there was a large propaganda movement, behind this, and a lot of money from recognizable names like Carnegie, Rockefeller, and Haynes Hosiery. The list goes on and on. And it's not pointing to these people to be culpable. But the notion is that there was a lot of, you know, philanthropy work for, you know, for people that thought themselves to be, you know, progressives at the time. And so that went into to fund movements under the name of the Human Betterment League. Mm-hmm. And the Human Betterment League was a propaganda machine. They wrote very convincing articles in newspapers, medical journals. They even created like children's book type material by the title of You Wouldn't Expect. And it's a really haunting piece of propaganda that was, you know, put out to help sway the public. So, it took time for right. It took time for it to be accepted. But, you know, at the time, it was a very, very popular notion.
I can understand. I suppose we can be charitable and say that humans make mistakes and we act on things that are irrational and emotional at some point. All of us probably do this. But after World War II, the Nazis engaged in this practice. That's what the Holocaust was all about. And the Nazis engaged in this, and that we had a series of trials. The Allies had a series of trials after the war to punish the Nazis for this practice and others like it. How could we then, why did we then, continue the practice in the United States?
Well, that's really interesting because Americans were actually the individuals that taught the Nazis these ideas. So it actually came from us. And so we sterilized in the United States 63,000 people, where in Nazi Germany they sterilized 450,000. So those ideas were actually taught from Francis Galton's work. And he was a half-cousin of Charles Darwin. And so that work actually came from us.
So what was the justification of continuing after World War II and we found out about the horrors of what happened in Nazi Germany and we put them on trial for it? How could we in good conscience continue to do the same thing? It's okay for us but not for them?
I think some individuals really saw this as, before there was access to birth control, access to contraceptives, access to abortion, that individuals really saw themselves as being advocates for women in some ways to be able to control their own reproduction when there wasn't other methods.
And I suppose the arguments have changed over time, but there are those who believe that contraceptives are wrong, that, you know, God put us here to procreate. And yet, did anybody bring up that argument against eugenics? Because sterilizing a person makes them unable to conceive children going forward, therefore.
It was interesting because what made eugenics go on for so long in North Carolina was that we didn't have organizations that really worked against it. For example, in North Carolina, we don't have a strong presence of the Catholic Church who, you know, probably would have brought these ideas to the forefront and tried to stop it from continuing.
But it was in 33 other states. I'm just curious about what our national conversation about this was, if indeed there was one about this topic at the time. Your research hasn't shown any of that?
Our focus has been mainly on on North Carolina itself. Okay. So those that's the debate outside of North Carolina and our, you know, what we've done preliminary, hasn't really included that topic.
We stopped this practice in 1974, and I suppose to our credit, North Carolina has come the closest to doing something for the victims of this who remain alive today. Former Governor Mike Easley did make an apology to them. And then we've talked about in the legislature some sort of monetary damage compensation. I've read two figures here, too. $20,000 per victim was, I think, the initial recommendation. And recently, I understand, it was $50,000 per victim has been proposed. But no funds have been appropriated. How did we get that close, even upping the ante, and then not follow through?
Well, I think the justification was that it was just a terrible budget time to make that kind of decision. It did pass the House, if I understand correctly, and when it went to the Senate, even though across both sides of the political aisle, folks were very moved by the testimony of the victims, and even those that you might have assumed to be conservative and err on the side of not wanting to fund reparation, they were emotionally leaning towards reparation, but because of the recession and the budget issues, decided that they couldn't make it a priority.
But you told me off the air that there were some people who looked at these victims, some of whom were not highly educated, some of whom lived lives of poverty, and said things like would they know what to do with the money?
There were some quotations like that from legislators. And I think that just we wouldn't ask that question of someone who was hit by a car, who was poor, and who was getting a settlement. So I think it just speaks to the fact that that sort of paternalistic view and that judgment of people in poverty may change shape over time, but it is still there.
Reparations is a very tricky subject because there are many things that we could make reparations for, slavery probably being the biggest thing in this country. And we've heard talk about reparations for slavery. How do you put a price tag on something like that? How do you put a price tag on sterilization of a human being?
That's a really interesting moral and economic question. I don't think any of us would say that we know that there's a number out there that we could put on somebody's life. But when you talk about it in economic terms, you then tend to ignore some of the material embodied impact of sterilization. And, you know, it's interesting to think about that the state of North Carolina definitely had a price tag on people's bodies, that they paid board members, they paid the doctors to do these sterilizations, and they all couched this in this sort of rhetoric of protection, that we're going to protect the community, we're going to protect people from parenthood, but in reality, what they were doing is they were protecting themselves from paying welfare benefits, and doing that, they ignored some of the structural issues of poverty that still exist.
I mean, with slavery, we've talked about this on this and other programs, the subject of reparations, the argument has been made that there is nobody alive today who has been directly affected one way or the other by slavery. Therefore, how would you pay? Who would you pay? How would you identify the people you would pay? And why should we pay? Because we didn't make those decisions. We weren't slave owners, and we didn't enforce the laws of the land at the time. With this, it's a little different, isn't it?
It is a little different. Some of the same standards of responsibility would apply in both cases, whether you're talking about eugenics or slavery. I think that the difference here, what makes the concrete connection to the past that you heard in the legislature for proponents of reparations, is that the survivors of this program, some of the survivors of this program, advocated for this bill and spoke to their own experiences to legislators. And something that we've noticed thematically patterned throughout the interviews with legislators who were supportive of this is they had actually talked to victims and felt a connection to the past that was very real, very material, and were morally moved to advocate for this. And the politics of the bipartisan politics of this case in North Carolina are very unique. You don't see this kind of bipartisan support for reparations in most cases. And what seemed to what seemed to shape support was whether people could connect to the past through the survivors of the program.
It raises all sorts of questions, and I suppose because there are many people have been hurt by policies and programs through time, and many of them probably arguably deserve some sort of compensation for their pain and suffering. But how do we determine who needs to be reparations needs to be paid to, and how do you redress, other than that, grievances from the past? Is an apology from a high-ranking official like the former governor enough?
I think we get back to the issue of budget being a reflection of priorities. And so if you can't, you know, put your money where your mouth is, then it's just an apology. And so I think in talking about this situation, for example, I'm thinking of one of the more well-known victims, Elaine Riddick, who has really spoken out about this. It's not that $50,000 is going to change a life. It's just putting some meat behind the apology. And that is meaningful. And I think many of the victims have said that will mean something to them.
Because a lot of people who are puzzled by this and are on the other side of this, who may not agree with this, will say, you know, okay, we took away their ability to have children. Aside from that, there was no monetary cost to them. Many of them remained on welfare. Many of them continued to have jobs and lead relatively full lives, absent the ability to have biological children. How do you put a price tag on that? Why should there be monetary compensation for that? And I'm just looking, I'm not advocating that side of the equation, but how do you answer that question?
Well, I would go back to something that Maggie said that's an important point, is real money went into these programs. And to come back around to the present and say that and to argue, as we often see, that you can't put a price on human life, that is technically an accurate statement. The injustice is always going to be, in these cases, disproportionate to any dollar amount that you could compensate a victim with. At the same time, there's something to the argument that $50,000 is better than zero.
So how do you arrive at $50,000 or $20,000? I mean, who came up with those numbers and why?
So the most recent number that was used in the budget package that was being put together that passed the House was $50,000. And I think $50,000 was used because that's the same number that the state would give to someone that was wrongfully convicted, wrongfully imprisoned for a crime, that the state offers restitution to those people. However, you know, they're not able to, you know, move forward with this. They were able to, pass compensation for wrongfully convicted. However, in $50,000, I'm fairly sure is, you know, how they arrived at that number.
I'm sure that if this took place here and in Nazi Germany, that it took place in other places around the world during that time period from the 1800s to the mid-70s. Were we the last state to stop this practice? Or the last area of the world to stop this practice in the 1970s?
It went on far, you know, far too long. There's other countries that have, you know, have owned up to the responsibility, that have given restitution to people in Canada and Scandinavia, other countries, and this is something that ended when civil rights started to become popular. So you could see there's a shift in sentiment that occurred, but. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, up to 74 it's still something that's with it. There's people that are living.
So I was going to ask you if in other areas of the world or in other states, if there are precedents for the types and the amount of compensation that one receives for an injustice like this.
I think in the Canada case, it was close to $100,000 that one of the individuals got who was sterilized against their will when that was brought up. So it is happening in other places, but we're the only state that has come as close as we have in talking about reparations. For example, California sterilized 20,000 individuals. We sterilized 7,600. And, you know, it's pretty impressive that we have come as far as we have in these conversations.
Would the compensation go for only the living people?
Yes.
Not the descendants of those who already passed?
Family members, descendants are not included in the $50,000.
We're talking about the ethics and the I guess it's conundrum, I don't know, of what you do in a situation like this to compensate victims who have been wrongfully affected by state policies. With Dr. Dan Grano, Dr. Maggie Quinlan, Elliot Hamer, who's a master's degree student at UNC Charlotte, where these two professors also teach, and Kirsten Sickley, who's the CEO of the YWCA. We're going to take a break, come back with more in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Sherpa Technology, staffing, recruiting, and project-based consulting services tailored to clients' critical technology initiatives. 704-374-0001 or online at SherpaLLC.com. Of course, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made her big testimony on Benghazi yesterday before both the House and Senate committees. And talked about understanding the security risks in North and West Africa. That'll be the subject of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. You can join that one. You can also join our conversation at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk. Talks. We're coming right back.
PRI's The World brings you voices from around the globe.
They're hiding these women not just from their relatives who want to punish them.
It's your daily source for international news and a gateway to cultures beyond our borders.
I think I'll use my skills to also help others be connected to this global village.
I'm Marco Werman. Join me right here for the next edition of The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about eugenics, the practice of, and the ethics of, or the moral responsibilities, the obligations we may or may not have to the remaining victims of that in North Carolina. It was a practice that was in place from 1929 to 1974. Gary on the web writes, "There have always been peoples and nations who felt they were superior to others. America is just one more of them. And our arrogance is one of the symptoms of a society which is in decline. To say that we continue to occupy moral high ground is simply not true." The late Dr. Rufus Fears of the University of Oklahoma stated that arrogance will eventually lead to a nation's downfall, and the eugenics program is one of the worst examples of arrogance. But not as national arrogance, because this was something that made the rounds around the world at the time, because we didn't know enough about things. We thought wrongly about this, about gene, the work of genetics in life, right?
Correct.
Just theoretically, philosophically, how do you put a value on a human life? Do you add up the earnings that person could have made in their lifetime, as is sometimes done? Do you add in the number of degrees they have that could have contributed to higher earnings? I mean, how do you do this? And in the case of, because you're looking like you're hesitating here, in the case of eugenics, when we're compensating victims, do we compensate them for emotional damages, or do we compensate them for things like, well, they couldn't have a child, but that child could have gone on to earn such and such, and so we have to compensate for that as well?
Well, I think one of the things you're compensating for is the fact that the state took away fundamental human choices that mm-hmm. this person could have made. Through a program that was funded and motivated by a desire to improve, supposedly improve the future of the state and lessening welfare cases and so on and so forth. So I think part of what we see the desire to compensate for is a state program with real investments that took away fundamental human decisions.
And certainly it happened, and certainly the people who made those decisions were wrong in doing so, even if they thought they were right at the time. But that leads to the question of those of us who had nothing to do with this. This ended in 1974. I didn't live here until 1985. And then there were other people who did live here, who are alive today, who had nothing to do with it. They had no say-so in the matter, may have disagreed with it, but they had nothing to do with it. Do we then have a moral obligation to pay something to these folks? Isn't that the crux of this issue?
It actually is, and it's the crux of most reparations debates. The idea that the present generation is innocent of the crime that's being compensated for. And so much from there depends on your attitude toward responsibility. So do you have to be directly culpable to live with the implications of a program like this? If you're a reparations advocate, you typically say no. You don't have to be directly culpable. We still live with structural inequities in race, education, healthcare, gender, and so on and so forth that the eugenics program is bound up with. So we live with the implications of programs like this. We live in structural inequities that have a real history. And if you are a reparations advocate, then the idea would be that living with those implications makes us responsible to address them in some way.
We have witnessed in recent years people being freed from death row or from life in prison because they were falsely accused and they served enormous amounts of time before modern forensic techniques have proven their innocence or their lack of guilt, and they have been released, and they have been compensated by the state for the time they spent in prison and for the lost income that resulted from that time spent in prison, that wrongful time spent in prison. Is there any difference in that and what we're talking about this morning? I had nothing to do with putting those people in prison. It was wrong, and it seems right to fix the wrong. Why does it seem so questionably right to fix the wrong in this case for some people? What's the difference?
I think it's an issue of, do you see people as your brothers and sisters, and are you their keeper? Or are we all living our own lives, not responsible to one another?
But the state made a mistake in some of these cases in putting people in jail and prison for a long period of time because they were wrongfully accused, falsely accused of rape, for instance. Mm-hmm. And we have gone back, freed them, and compensated them for their time spent in prison. And not that anything can compensate for that, it would seem to me. And we don't, excuse the term, bitch about it. We don't question it. We just do it. I don't understand the difference.
Well, this is a really interesting historical moment that we're even having the conversation about reparations, that this is a chance for North Carolina, as somebody who supports reparations, if it came to that, that we have a chance to do more than just say that we're sorry. We have an opportunity to say that, you know, yes, you are human beings, you matter. This is a chance for us to reflect mm-hmm. on where we've been, where we're going, so that we don't repeat some of the same mistakes.
And I would add to Maggie's comment that I get what you're asking, Mike, I think, now. When you have someone who's unjustly accused and serves time and loses so much of their freedom
and their life
serving a sentence, that, to me, would seem much more clear to the average citizen that that was an injustice and that we took away their freedom. There's so much, as Dan intimated, bound up in race and gender inequities and economic inequities that people sometimes are quicker to judge that this person might have made poor choices because of the fact that they were on welfare, because they were poor, because they had a child before they were 18. And so I think that's been part of the discussion about it doesn't seem as clear.
Yes, but many of the people who have been freed from prison for being wrongfully accused are African Americans. Mm-hmm. And they were wrongfully accused and prosecuted because they were African Americans and not white. And if they had been white, many of them would not have been prosecuted to the degree or imprisoned for the length of time that some of these people are imprisoned. And not that every African American in prison is innocent. Some are not. But many are there because of race. So what's the difference? Both of these are, it seems to me, somewhat racial and certainly socioeconomic issues.
It's a good point. And, you know, I don't have the answer to it.
Okay. Let's go to Chris in Cornelius. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you for the opportunity. I did want to first say that I am not an advocate for this disgraceful atrocity that has been imposed upon the people I consider my fellow citizens and my brothers and sisters. There, based on your discussion, does seem to be an initial idea that prompted this. The example that I always like to use with good ideas gone wrong, communism looks good on paper, but in practice, we know the results. Now, the idea that seems in my research and this discussion for the eugenics program may very well, arguably, been to keep people from having feeble-minded children and sentencing those children to an extraordinarily difficult life. There are friends of mine who have chosen voluntarily, and that is the key, to not have biological children because of one case, the mother is epileptic. But that's not what happened. Now, that's my first point. Making a judgment call on human lives is disgraceful. It's not unusual. It's not the first time it's happened. But it can still happen. And the end of this first point is that there is still genetic testing that is done in certain countries, industrialized countries of the world, to determine success of employees. So even though the eugenics program has ended by the grace of God, there's still genetic screening for value of human life still going on.
And Chris, your second point is what?
My second point is when you're looking at reparations, there is absolutely a huge difference when you're looking at people where they were convicted, a mistake was made, and that is why wrongfully convicted. A mistake was made, and the state is required and is generally accepted that they make those reparations. When people were sterilized against their will, that was not a mistake. The action was, but it was a deliberate action. And that should put the reparations at a far higher priority and moral obligation than a mistake in the judicial process.
Yeah, he brings up, thank you. He brings up an interesting point. It seems to me that he's right. If you do something deliberately as opposed to accidentally, then you've done it with malice. Mm-hmm. Was this done with malice, in your opinion, or were the intentions by the people? Can we determine the intentions of the people involved in this practice?
Well, I think as it began from our discussions, a lot of people felt that they were acting in good conscience. I do think it's difficult to untangle the driver that's an economic driver about reducing the welfare rolls.
Does intention matter in this case? Or is it simply purely the fact that it occurred that should matter?
Especially since I don't think we can go back and determine intention in every case where the decision was made. We really have to focus on the injustice.
Thank you for your call, Chris. If did you want to comment on that?
Well, and I was going to add to that rationale matters, right? So if there's a rationale by which this program was implemented, part of it has to do with determining based on race, class, and other indicators the kinds of traits that supposedly ground a stable society. Mm-hmm. And I think the last caller makes some of these points very well, that we have to be very aware of the continuation of that rationale in current injustices as well.
You know, we keep being told we live in this litigious society that drives the cost of everything up because of lawsuits and the fear of being sued, and this goes from the medical industry to other industries as well. Is the fear here, and is it a justified fear, and is it a fear that we should all have as citizens who will have to foot the bill for this and other reparations packages, that if we successfully offer reparations to victims here, that we've opened Pandora's box, that we have set a precedent that suddenly we'll be making reparations for everything that every slight that we can litigate?
This is a very, very common, along with the innocence idea, is a very, very common concern and an understandable one. There's a little bit of a slippery slope argument implied there, right? But again, it comes down to, we've talked already about budgets being about priorities. Prioritization is something that has to be considered here, and this is an injustice that's in front of us. It's a very, very concretely tied injustice to the North Carolina legislature, to North Carolina program. And I think there's something to be said to dealing with the injustice in front of us if there's a compelling reason to. Does it open a Pandora's box of other possibilities? Maybe so, but maybe those cases are legitimate as well.
Because it is a question of affordability, after all, at some point, and of burdening taxpayers today with the need to pay for the wrongs of the past. So how do we balance the needs of the present, which are many and money is short, with what might be morally or ethically the right thing to do?
I think by thinking of the past and present together. What does it mean to live today with this injustice on our watch? And is it worth it to do something to address this, ethically speaking, in order to repair the injustice and also repair the condition of our relationship to survivors?
I know that, Maggie, one of the things that interested you about looking into this it was because of our perception of eugenics laws. You say that the ways they are talked about in current debates about reparations tells us a lot about the value we have for people with disabilities, those who are mentally ill, African Americans, single mothers, individuals on welfare. What do these conversations tell you?
Well, if you think about even just our understanding of IQ, it's still embedded in some racist, classist decisions. IQ should never be a judgment on somebody's worth or somebody's value. And even, you know, if we attempt to get rid of people who we consider of low IQ, that what as a community, what as a society will we miss out on some of the variability that it can offer the world? And, you know, even I think a lot of this work is still embedded in ideas about African-American women or African-Americans and their sexuality and being sexually out of control, or women not being able to control their own bodies, that at this time the husband was considered to have owned the woman's fallopian tubes and had control over that decision. And, you know, you see this still today, that I have an African-American student who had a child, was not married at the age of 18, and when she went in to have her child, she said, "This is going to be my last child. I'd like for my fallopian tubes to be tied." And what the doctor said was, "You need to come back when you're 25 or when you're older, and, you know, you can't make that decision now." And at 25, she still wanted that decision, and, you know, would have been a lot easier for her if they did it after she gave birth. And so you still see these ideas happening today, and, you know, people are afraid of, in our state, of being sued because of it.
It's Dr. Maggie Quinlan, Assistant Professor in the Department of Communication Studies at UNC Charlotte, along with Dr. Dan Grano, an Associate Professor there, and Elliot Hamer, a Master's Degree student, all three of them looking into this history of and the impact of eugenics and the practice of eugenics in North Carolina and the possibility of reparations. And also with us, Kirsten Sickley, who's the CEO of the YWCA. This is a topic that they have shouldered for the next several months. Thank you all for being here.